The battle continues.
This is KBOO Portland. The time now is 10 o'clock, or is 11 o'clock, I'm sorry. Coming up next on Between the Covers, David Naiman interviews Elvio Wilk, author of Oval. And at 11:30, it's Words and Pictures. SW Concert speaks with Matt Boers, founder of the NIB based in Portland. The NIB is a publisher of political comics and graphic journalism. Don't forget that you can hear all of these programs after they air at KBOO.fm or on iTunes or Google Play. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm or use our mobile app and click on Donate.
KBOO Community Radio holds an open meeting concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The Program Advisory Committee meets the second Tuesday of each month at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
Good morning and welcome to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host. Today's guest is the writer Elvio Wilk. Elvio Wilk was a founding editor of the Berlin-based architecture magazine Uncube and the publications editor for Transmediale, the journal associated with the annual Berlin Festival of Art, Culture, and Technology of the same name. Based in New York and Berlin, Elvio Wilk has published her writings in Frieze, Art Forum, Metropolis, Moose, Flash Art, and Art in America, among others, and is currently a contributing editor at eFlux Journal and finishing a master's degree at the New School for Social Research. She has taught at the University of the Arts Berlin, Eugene Lang College, and City College of New York, and she's here today to talk about her debut novel out from Soft Skull Press, entitled Oval. Kirkus in its starred review calls Oval deeply weird and unsettlingly hilarious. Jeff Vandermeer calls it a fascinating near-future exploration of relationships, sustainability, and power. Sasha Frere Jones says of Oval, everything is work. Mourning, clubbing, reading your partner's moods, and everything is a scam. Plants that become buildings, jobs that become consultancies, apps that become jobs. With astonishing emotional accuracy, Oval records what it feels like to hover between two poles. Finally, Mackenzie Warrick describes Oval as J.G. Ballard meets William Gibson meets Jeff Vandermeer. Oval is an up-to-the-minute story about the twilight zones of corporate design, aesthetics, pharmacy, and bioengineering, where there's nothing consultants won't break in the quest for innovation. What could possibly go wrong? Find out in Elvio Wilk's crisp and stylish debut book. Welcome to Between the Covers, Elvio Wilk.
Thank you for having me.
So before we dive into the ideas animating the book, let's orient listeners to the situation they encounter as they open Oval. Talk to us about Lewis and Anya, who they are, where they are, and what they do.
Lewis and Anya are the main characters of the story, and they are a couple. One is a man, one is a woman. They live on a mountain called the Berg in an experimental eco-settlement. The Berg is a fictional imposition on this reality-adjacent version of Berlin that they live in. And many things about their Berlin universe are very similar to what anyone living in Berlin might experience, and many of them are tweaked or exaggerated or ramped up.
And what do Anya and Lewis do?
So Anya is a researcher at a biotech sort of branch of a large corporation that owns much of the city's real estate. She works in cartilage architecture research.
tell us a little bit about that before we move
right.
on from there.
I'll just say one word about that. It's so far as, well, as far as I know, not yet a thing that is happening in the world, but she's developing at this department called RANDI, Research About Nature Department, indefinite. The applications for sprouting cartilage cells on demand in remote regions of the world where they could become sort of flexible housing, for instance. So this kind of like programmable wet material. Lewis works for an NGO, which is called Basquiat with two T's, where he is the artist in residence / artist in consultants / sort of like brand of of the NGO, and it is his job to basically perform institutional critique on behalf of the institution. And eventually he sort of invents a pill called Oval, which is where the story gets its name. And his goal is to address and maybe solve Berlin's income disparity by giving people this drug that will induce financial generosity.
That was a pretty incredible summary for both of them. But let's back up a minute and talk a little bit about the Berg, the artificial mountain where the corporate eco-settlement is, where they live. So if you were to pitch the Berg to us or to Lewis and Anya, why would someone want to live on the Berg in an eco-settlement such as this?
Right. So in the story, they're sold on it because it's offered to them for free, first of all. Berlin is becoming more unaffordable. It's actually via a connection of Anya's that they're offered this sort of like exciting and cool opportunity. So part of it is this like cool cultural capital of living in this sustainable experiment. Part of it is that it's quite beautiful and awesome to live on a mountain in the middle of a city. But I should say that that's how it might be pitched to them in the book, but the Berg has actually been pitched to the city of Berlin in reality by an architecture firm called Miele, who several years ago rose to the challenge of one of these public competitions for a plan for architects to offer plans for how to develop the former Tempelhof airfield, which is one of the largest undeveloped public spaces in Europe right now. It was just left over. It was a Nazi airport that closed in 2001, and now there's nothing there. And periodically over decades, the city has said, what should we put here? And a bunch of architects suggest something, and then the city says, no, nothing. We want nothing. And the citizens vote for undevelopment. So this proposal for a quote, vertical nature park, as they called it, to put this mountain there, instead of condos, instead of a museum, just like, let's double the city's green space and people can hike and ski.
Wow.
And then they sort of perpetuated this hoax that this was maybe really going to happen.
But it never was going to happen.
It did happen in my book.
Right, of course. Well, one of the great joys of preparing for the interview with you is doing a deep dive into all of the of your unusual interests. So on the eFlux podcast, you've interviewed people about abuses of power in the art world, about a project called Ergonomic Futures, which explores future scenarios for imagining new types of human bodies. And you've interviewed people about non-human collective intelligences. You yourself have also written about slime mold intelligence, about wetware, which I'm guessing is related to this cartilage architecture
somewhat
endeavor of Anya's, about computers, so computers made of organic biological material. You've written about virtual reality and the literary movement called the New Weird, among a lot of other things. but even as many of these interests find themselves in some fashion or form in Oval, it did provoke my curiosity about how the book began for you as a project. Were there certain questions or curiosities that animate or anxieties that animated you working on Oval as a novel?
Yeah, I think part of the process of writing, well, first of all, was realizing that my life is a series of eccentric hobbies that I've sort of cobbled together into a half career. And the great thing about fiction, which was also kind of this like horrible thing, was trying to put everything in it. You know, as soon as I started, and I started with the relationship between the two characters, really trying to figure out this sort of like their gender dynamic and their power dynamic. The story starts when Lewis's mother dies. So the emotional core of the story for me is this problem of how they're dealing with his grief and how she ends up sort of co-opting his grief process and unable to imagine empathizing with him in a way that doesn't turn out to be really her own emotional projection. So that still is sort of the core to me of what drives the story, even though a whole lot of other stuff is at different points kind of picking up and driving it. And I think those different strands, there's like a fine line in having, you know, having too many and having enough, that there's a world that has its own internal logic and surface tension and holds together. But over time, I mean, over a few years of writing, I just ended up, it was just everything went into it. It's just, and so most of the writing process ultimately was just trying to get rid of the stuff that just didn't belong or confuse things too much, which is why probably a lot of the texts and sort of projects that you referenced were things that I sort of came upon while working on the book and then ended up being like, okay, I can't add this to their world. I'd better write an essay about it.
Oh, interesting. So the novel process generated essays.
It generated a ton of stuff.
Huh. Well, in Book Forum, Maria Dimitrova reviews Oval and quotes an article by the novelist Tom McCarthy, who you've also been in conversation with before. The article's called The Death of Writing. And in it, he argued that fiction has retreated into quote-unquote comforting nostalgia, and that it has been replaced by funky architecture firms, digital media companies, and brand consultancies that have assumed the mantle of the cultural avant-garde. And he concludes by saying, if there's an individual alive in 2015 with the genius and vision of James Joyce, they're probably working for Google. And Maria Dimitrova says, your book seems to exist within this world that McCarthy paints in this quote, with any future James Joyce not writing books, but consulting for a corporation on the corporation's behalf. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to think a little bit with you about the world of Oval in this light, what an artist and what language might look like in your imagined near future. Does this co-optation of artists by corporations that McCarthy imagines and that your character Lewis is an example of, do you feel like that is the trajectory we're on in the world, that you're sort of, when you talk about Berlin being reality adjacent, that you're turning up the volume on a trend that you see or fear?
I see it everywhere, and in the arts certainly it becomes a focal point. It sort of focuses a whole set of problems when you have this, there's just such an old idea of the arts as sort of existing in a vacuum, or kind of being not, like the artists aren't like implicit and instrumentalized like anyone else politically, or that there's a that you could resist co-option through artwork, when in reality I think that's like historically just doesn't really add up. Artists have always been implicated in systems of power, part of them wittingly or unwittingly. What's happening now, which seems it seems quite like most of what I put in the book is pretty much borrowed from life. I interviewed several artists who are also consultants and just have a lot of friends who work kind of like partially in a corporate sphere, partially in an art production sphere. Maybe they also write criticism. Maybe they also do kind of like ad copy. Just all of these things are existent, and it makes sense. The economy of the art world doesn't sustain kind of singular production in the way that we might have a fantasy that it does. So there's not a lot of choice when it comes to supporting oneself, which I also think is not historically recent. But anyway, I guess your question is getting at this idea of complicity versus criticality, and whether or not it's possible to be both. And I think it is, because I think it always has been. I think just the structures that were embedded in are so much more totalizing than they might have been before, and pervade every aspect of our lives, that it becomes magnified. And especially when you have this question of what art's role is, when we really should be asking, what is everyone complicit? How are we all complicit? And is it possible to find places of critique, but maybe more interestingly, resistance in the cracks of this totalizing, corporatized, for-profit universe that most of us live in? And I think it is, but I also never want to argue that the only way to resist is from within, because I still believe in efforts of resisting from without. Even if it's an illusion that there's an outside to capitalism, I still believe in, you know, arranging a union or organizing in various ways that are sort of more traditionally antagonistic to a center of power. At the same time, I don't think it's by no means the only way, and I also think it's a bit, what's the right way to put it? It's not the only way, and it has to, like, I think those sort of traditionally antagonistic methods need to coexist and acknowledge the idea of becoming implicated in something in order to explode it or in order to find ways to work within it.
So when you say this is really more an extension of something that's existed for a long time rather than something science fictional that you're imagining in the future, is it in the same light as, say, like, you go to a museum and all the art you see is of a certain century, is from as portraits of aristocrats and their families, or Mozart's church music? Would he have written church music if the church wasn't a patron, and would these painters be painting these people's faces if money and patronage wasn't part of the problem?
Yeah, that's part of it, this idea that somebody always has to pay for the art on one level. I guess I'm thinking about more like recent historical developments of the relationship between art and industry. So, for instance, one of my favorite examples is the Artist Placement Group that existed in the UK several decades ago, where artists were placed in industrial or kind of like corporate contexts throughout Britain, and given the job to not produce value, basically, to not be useful, and to not serve the interests of the industry, and for the industry not to serve the interests of the artist, which leaves this fascinating question, whose interests are being served by the artist being there? And John Latham, who was one of the organizers, proposed this idea of the invisible third client, which in that day probably meant the public, like the public client, like whoever that may be, but not for profit and not for the art world, like something else. And that's been, today I think about it much more on like an environmental scale or a planetary scale, like the third client being like all of us. And
and us not just being humans then.
Exactly, us beyond the human. Expanding that idea of the human as like the central audience, I think is actually really fascinating to try to to try to do. But yeah, there is this sort of sense of, yes, somebody's always had to pay for the art, but then there's also the sense that, especially as, like, you know, capital production ramped up and, like, I guess, like, industrial development and then eventually, like, tech development and the tech and science industries, especially in the U.S., that's when the questions of complicity really start to irk people and freak people out. So those are kind of the moments that I've been looking at kind of in the last century to try and understand, like, are those terms even right anymore?
In case you just tuned in, we're talking today to Elvia Wilk about her debut novel from Soft Skull called Oval. Well, to think about this question of complicity and fighting from within and fighting from without, one thing that is obvious about your near future world of the co-opted artist consultant is that language has been turned against itself, and it's divorced itself from its own meaning. And I really liked what Katie Wallman in The New Yorker said, and it's better than how I could say it, so I'm just gonna quote her. She said, "One particularly eerie fact about Oval is that you cannot read it literally. You cannot travel along a sentence and accept it at face value and decide whether the idea expresses whether the idea expressed seems sound or admirable or foolish or reprehensible. You must work backward from who's speaking to decode the meaning of the words. For instance, when representatives of the large organizations that employ Anya and Lewis talk of philanthropy, sustainability, and justice, they are not, we surmise, actually talking about philanthropy, sustainability, and justice, but let Anya ruminate on the same nouns in the privacy of her bathroom, and they glow with an abiding human value. So I was hoping maybe you could talk a little bit about your sentences that, according to Waldman, can't be read literally in relationship to this larger conceptual project of Oval for us.
I also liked that point that she made a lot. That was one of those rare, wonderful moments when somebody says something to you about your work that tells you about your work in a way and gave me something. It was really like a generative kind of idea, I thought, because I do think a lot about the role of language. Hopefully not to digress, but especially kind of coming from a world of art speak, where I had kind of learned to write as an art critic, where you're really given a set of vocab that you can use, and trying to subvert that vocab is just going to make it worse. So, you know, this where you just feel like you're trapped in lingo. And same in architecture. When I was writing about architecture, I was really trying to figure out, like, what is the language of describing architecture that isn't a press release? And like, it's quite difficult, actually. So this idea that the these kind of hollowed out terms that circulate in the world of the book, like, I suppose, innovation or like futurity or various other bits of jargon. There's also some art jargon at various points, like this kind of character who's absorbed the language of an art press release and can't put together her own sentences. But I'm really, still trying to figure out what it would mean to, if not reinvest those words with some kind of human meaning or clout, what other words we could have. I don't know if it's possible, but I do believe that, like, branding speak has done something really strange to us, because no matter how aware we are of it, it is also our language. And I don't know, I think this idea of the character kind of in her bathroom trying to figure out, like, what is empathy? What is generosity? I'm like, of course we all do that. It's not as if empathy doesn't exist just because a company is capitalizing on the idea of empathy. But how difficult to tease those things apart, and how difficult to figure out what empathy could be if it weren't an instrumentalized experience to have.
Well, I marked out one paragraph that I'd hope you read that is sort of an example of corporate art speak.
Sure.
Maybe a parody on corporate art speak, I'm not sure, but on page 89.
Okay. I'll just give a small amount of context. So the characters are... So Anya is sitting with her two friends, Laura and Damian, who are her best friends, and they realize that the two friends don't really know what her job is because it's so jargon-laden, and they've never really tried to figure out what she's doing there. So they're kind of reading from the website of this organization, Randy, where she is a researcher. So this is Laura scrolling the website and sort of just repeating the mission statement of Randy. Okay. Randy is nothing more and nothing less than a place to tackle our world's greatest challenges by resolutely not tackling them. We've handpicked the best and most cutting-edge thinkers across scientific disciplines in order to finally resolve humanity's most profound questions about nature, not through products and solutions, but through speculative speculations on the future. After half a decade of collaboration with external consultants in the field of knowledge management, we at Finster have discovered that the key to advancing scientific research in the laboratory context is not to try to advance scientific research. This is really hard to read. After half a decade of collaboration with external consultants in the field of knowledge management, we at Finster have discovered that the key to advancing scientific research in the laboratory context is not to try to advance science, but to try to advance creativity. It's yeah. quite hard to read. It's really like a, yeah. it's unpleasant.
Yeah, it makes me want to retreat to the bathroom and yeah. meditate on what empathy is. Well, as you mentioned earlier, the emotional core and tension of the book is that Lewis comes back from his mom's funeral and doesn't seem to be grieving, at least to Anya. He doesn't seem to be grieving. And this apparent lack of grief and his disengagement with any sort of visible emotional vulnerability since his mom died becomes a growing tension between them as a couple and a distance. And the irony of it all is that we eventually learn that during this time of Lewis's supposed emotional self-estrangement, he's working on a pharmaceutical, Oval, that he hopes will make people more empathetic. So you had mentioned that he wants it as one solution to Berlin's income inequality, but could you pitch the concept? If you were Lewis, how would you sell us on Oval?
Like, right.
What is Oval supposed to do? How is it going to be distributed? And, and you know, what are the hopes and aspirations? And even if you want the supposed biology around it.
Right. So I think that Lewis's idea, before I step into his shoes, that there's a fundamental sort of disconnect between the idea of empathy and the idea of generosity. So empathy, what we think it is feeling for another person by putting ourselves in their position and experiencing or imagining their subject experience for ourselves. Generosity, in the sense that Lewis is interested, is financial generosity, sort of this redistribution of wealth through, like, giving money to people on the street who need it, for instance. And he sees these things as kind of the same, that feeling for another means giving money. And this is, you know, the fundamental concept that neoliberal philanthropy is premised on, this idea that it's on individuals to feel feelings and that those feelings will prompt them to contribute to causes and save the world. This is markedly not working very well. It also sucks to have that responsibility placed on us as individuals rather than thinking of ourselves as collectives and sort of like contributing to structures. But in any case, to devil's advocate, to be Lewis for a moment, the very provocative question that he continues to ask, Anya, for instance, is why does it matter why you give somebody the money that they need to eat? Does it matter that it is quote-unquote artificial? Or is it really that maybe speculatively that instinct to give what one has actually been marred by structures of capitalism that promote self-interest, and that maybe kind of like removing the veil of capitalism in the brain could, it's, you know, it's absurd, but it's you know, it's an earnest proposal on his part. He's truly proposing a functional fix in the bodies of people who live in Berlin. So rather than a top-down one, really a networked fix.
And it's going to be distributed through a club drug.
Yeah, it's basically going to be panned off as a club drug, partially because he sees the culture class as like the last bastion of complete selfishness who need to be unlocked for spare change. And also because, well, it is not hard to distribute drugs in Berlin that way. That might actually be the fastest way to get anything into the water supply. It's like standing outside Berghain. But it's also, I guess, because there is kind of like nightlife presents various clashes of different groups. And so like you might actually be more likely to encounter somebody in a position of less privilege at night outside. So he also has this kind of like like ridiculous but also kind of sad and sweet idea of this encounter with somebody on the street where you're sort of propelled and impelled to connect with them and help them.
It was great having you on the show.
It was great being here. Thanks.
We are talking today to Elvia Wilk about her debut novel, Oval, from Soft School Press. You've been listening to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Montevilla Jazz Festival on Saturday, August 17th and Sunday, August 18th at Portland Metro Arts in Portland. The Montevilla Jazz Festival features performances by Brian Smith, Dana Reason, Mel Brown and Gordon Lee, and many more. Again, that's the Montevilla Jazz Festival on Saturday, August 17th and Sunday, August 18th at Portland Metro Arts, 9003 Southeast Stark Street in Portland. KBOO will be broadcasting live from the festival on Saturday from 2 p.m. to 10 p.m. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Coming up next on KBOO on Words and Pictures, SW Concerts speaks with Matt Boers, founders of the NIB. Based in Portland, the NIB is a publisher of political comments and graphic journalism. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Dark Side Cinema, open every night and featuring independent, foreign, and art house films. The Dark Side is located at 215 Southwest 4th Street between Madison and Jefferson Avenues in Corvallis, Oregon. More information and showtimes is available online at darksidecinema.com.
Welcome to Words and Pictures, the show about the narrative arts. I'm your host, S.W. Conser, and today I'm joined in the studio by two of the leading lights in comics journalism. They hail from continents on opposite sides of the globe, but they've come together here in Portland to publish some of the most politically aware cartoons of our time. Matt Boers is a frequent guest on Words and Pictures. His voice, his work has appeared in The Nation, The Daily Beast, and The Village Voice. And he was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in editorial cartooning back in 2012. He is now